Hello and welcome to episode 9 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series, which you can find on iTunes and YouTube. This episode features a panel from the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled Imagining an Authentic 21st Century U.S. Left. The first speaker is Paul Street, whose website states that he is an independent, radical democratic policy researcher, journalist, historian, author, and speaker based in Iowa City, Iowa, and Chicago, Illinois. The second speaker will be Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. He is a veteran journalist who co-founded America's Black Forum in 1977. ABF was the first nationally syndicated black news interview program. The third speaker will be Chris Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, New York Times best-selling author, former professor at Princeton University, activist, and ordained Presbyterian minister. And now, Paul Street.
In 1848, Marx Engels wrote that the class struggle between producers and appropriators always ends either in a revolutionary transformation of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. Folks, common ruin is precisely where we are headed 170 years later as capital turns the planet into a giant greenhouse gas chamber, a crime, by the way, that will make the Nazis look like small-time thugs by comparison. The rich, Hervé Kempf pointed out a decade ago, are destroying the earth. Well, not the earth itself, just all chances for a decent, organized human future. The bourgeoisie, if I might use a forgotten term, isn't doing this because it's loaded with ecological Scrooges who need to be visited by the ghosts of environmental Christmas past, present, and future. Capitalists are driven to pillage, poison the commons by systemic imperatives, compelling them to commodify everything under the sun, to maniacally push infinite growth, permanent accumulation on a finite planet. For any authentic left today, as for Marx in his time, the moral predisposition of bourgeois elites is of little concern. It's not about speaking truth to wealth and power. There's no appealing to capitalist better angels where money and profit are concerned. We're not trying to act out a Charles Dickens novel where Mr. Brownlow saves the day for young waif Oliver Twist, or where the mean capitalist Scrooge becomes the nice benevolent capitalist Scrooge. Real leftists know that five absurdly rich people holding the same net worth between them as the bottom half of the species is capitalism working. That's the system working. The top tenth of the upper 1%, possessing as much wealth as the nation's bottom 90%, owning most of the nation's politicians and policymakers, along with the media, most of the educational apparatus. Folks, that's the system working. Returning to its 500-year inegalitarian plutocratic norm. We know that giant corporations buying up nearly every last family farm, tapping every new reserve of cheap global labor, stealing the Congo's precious raw materials, crafting so-called public policy in their own private interests, extracting, burning every last fossil fuel. We know that's capitalist working. The military-industrial complex generating profits for so-called defense firms and concocting pretexts for endless imperial intervention while our schools and parks and infrastructure and social safety nets are underfunded. That, people, too, is capitalism working. I could go on and on in this vein. The only solution a real left, along with Marx, knows is for workers and citizens to organize collectively to overthrow the profit system, to take control of what they produce, how they produce it, how society is organized. Power to the people, power to the workers, and power to the commons, whose enclosure was and remains the making of the modern wage-enslaved working class, also the making of modern slavery, and the making of modern mass incarceration, curiously enough. This is what I've always understood to be the basic, irreducible, bottom-line perspective of anything since the time of Karl Marx, Frederick Douglass, and Bakunin to be the left. I'm always amused when I hear some reporter, some talking head, politician, pundit refer to, quote, the left. The left, as in the left won't like Trump's tax plan, or the left is gearing up for the 2018 midterms, the left this, the left that. What big, powerful left are they talking about? And by the way, where do I join? In the dominant reigning media politics culture, it refers primarily to the Democratic Party, but for anyone who knows anything about the actual history of radical movements, calling the dismal, demobilizing, dollar-drenched Democrats the left is like calling the National Pork Producers Association a vegan lobbying organization. As the multimillionaire House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi told a young Bernie fan during a CNN town hall last year, we're capitalists and that's just the way it is. Presidential candidate Barack Obama gushed praise for the lords of capital and their glorious profit system, which he called a source of a prosperity that's unmatched in history. As president, his Goldman Sachs Citigroup vetted policy hands did more for the nation's leading financial institutions and corporations than any republic could ever dream of having done. And Obama was actually proud of this, boasted about it. He's been cashing in on it ever since. Many progressives call for the Dems to abandon their corporate and cultural elitism and return to its purported grand mission of, you know, fighting for social justice and ensuring the workers get a fair deal, like back in the days of Franklin Roosevelt. When will the Democrats learn how to win? But it isn't about winning for the DDDs, the dismal dollar-drenched Dems. It's about serving corporate masters. As William Kaufman told Barbara Ehrenreich, believe it or not, on Facebook, but I noticed it and I saved it. You know, it was just by chance I was going through the feed. As he told her last year, Democrats aren't feckless, inept, stupid, unable to learn what it takes to win. They're corrupt. They don't want to win with an authentically progressive program because it would threaten the interests of their corporate donor base. The Democrats are full-grown adults. They know exactly what they're doing. They have a business model subserving the interest of the financial elite. So what if Bernie Sanders probably would have prevailed, or very possibly would have prevailed over Trump in 2016? The reigning corporate Dems would rather lose to the right, even to a proto-fascistic white nationalist eco-exterminist white, than lose to the left, even to a mildly progressive social democratic left within their own party. Russiagate, among other things, is the inauthentic opposition, as Sheldon Wolin called the Democrats, following its business model, doing its job, working to cover its tracks, and to throw the debacle of its neoliberal corporatist politics down Orwell's memory hole. Russiagate is meant to provide corporate Democrats cover, not only for 2016, but also for 2018 and 2020. It advances a narrative that lets Dems continue nominating business-friendly neoliberal shills and imperialists who pretend to be progressive while they are owned by the nation's unelected dictatorships of money and empire. This year's crop of congressional candidates is loaded with military and intelligence veterans, including in the district in Bloomfield where I'm staying during the left forum, where the politicos are all meeting me and canvassing me on behalf of some woman who's running for Congress. And what's her great selling point? 10 years in the military. This is a reflection of the Democrats' determination to run as the true party of empire. Not that Bernie was all that left. Bernie, F-35 Sanders, occasional carefully hedged claims to be a Democratic socialist, were contradicted, I at least thought, in Iowa by his quiescence on the American empire. You know, it takes real chutzpah to trumpet Scandinavia as your social democratic role model without noting once that Sweden, Denmark, and Norway pay tiny percentages of their budgets on militarism. And failure to tackle the war budget, as Dr. King pointed out in 1967, means you can't pay for poverty-ending progressive transformation at home. Sanders has never seriously criticized modern class rule, deeply understood, and along the way he helped sustain, I think, progressives' deadly attachment to the nation's time-staggered, narrow, election candidate-centered politics. Howard Zinn used to say that the really critical thing isn't who's sitting in the White House, it's who's sitting in the streets, in the cafeterias, in the halls of government, and in the factories. And I'm afraid Bernie was and remains very much about the master's election cycle, which is dedicated to the delusional notion that we, the people, get meaningful input into policy by spending 3 minutes in a voting booth once every 2 or 4 years, choosing from among a handful of candidates selected in advance for us by the nation's unelected financial dictatorship. Democrats know that lots of citizens and activists think like Zinn. That's why they set up AstroTurf outfits like Indivisible, Move On, Town Hall Project, fake resistance groups masquerading as extra electoral grassroots movements, but whose real purpose is to channel everything into a big get out the vote campaign for candidates affiliated with the not so leftmost of the two reigning corporate parties. Now, a number of Sanders supporters have migrated into DSA, the Democratic Socialists of America. A lot of good people that I know are doing that. I looked at its recent, at its online video, Thanks Capitalism, which seems to define socialism as little more than collective bargaining agreements and civil rights. The video says nothing about capitalism's destruction of livable ecology or about its evil twin, imperialism. There's a panoply of sometimes progressive of substantially progressive advocacy, policy, and service organizations that can be found across the country. They tend to be crippled by single issuism relating to their silo-inducing dependence on private foundations. There are many multi-issue, nonpartisan, progressive policy lobbying protest groups in the citizen action tradition across the country. Their 501c3 status prevents them from overtly identifying as Democratic Party-affiliated groups, but that's pretty much what they are. Authentic radicals who want to keep their jobs know to tread carefully and watch their backs when they work in the progressive nonprofits sector. I have all kinds of stories about that. It's the same in higher education and the so-called labor movement. We've seen hopeful seeds and moments, and I've participated in many of them, of people's organizing over the years, briefly inspiring developments like the Wisconsin Rebellion, Occupy, Fight for 15, the Chicago subsequent statewide teacher strikes, Verizon strike, the movement against racist police killings, which is a movement bigger than just the Ford Foundation funded and Borley Alice Foundation coordinated Black Lives Matter. There's been the Malcolm X grassroots movement, We Charge Genocide, Standing Rock, the broader struggle that I was part of in Iowa against the Dakota Access Pipeline, the successful campaign against the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I think the remarkable alternative economy developments led by black leftists in Jackson, Mississippi, which to me is one of the most really remarkable and hopeful developments going on right now. Now we have the Poor People's Campaign just under the way, under the leadership of Reverend William Barber. I know other panelists are going to talk about the PPC, and I'm going to leave any comments I have on that till later. I will say this, though. In his final years, Dr. King, leader of the original Poor People's Campaign, became less and less reluctant to name the disease that was causing poverty as capitalism. He acknowledged that he was fighting what he called a class struggle. The real issue, Dr. King, who's been sanitized in the official American Orwellian historical memory and who, in fact, was a democratic socialist. The real issue to be faced, King wrote in his very last essay, posthumously published, is the radical reconstruction of society itself. For now, and this must change, the U.S. left is too scattered, excessively siloed, overly dependent on corporate foundations, excessively episodic, excessively metropolitan and bicoastal, excessively professional and middle class, insufficiently working class, insufficiently anti-capitalist, and insufficiently distanced from the Democratic Party, and excessively, I think, identity politicized. I'm not against identity as part of our political practice, but there's a left way of handling identity, and there's a neoliberal bourgeois way of handling identity. Now, I will say this. In some hyper-identity-politicized so-called left circles now, you are damn near suspected of being a racist or a sexist and or a homophobe for using the phrase working class, or for preferring the time-tested, easily understood word solidarity over the somewhat confusing academic term intersectionality. Some so-called left folks will look at you like you're a demented Stalinist dinosaur if you dare to observe that not every single last white American in the country is super privileged simply because of the color of their skin. I get resistance from so-called lefties in campus town America when I suggest spending less time shaming white working class people for their color privilege and more time on appealing to their basic economic class interest in forming solidarity with their fellow workers of different races and ethnicities. There's nothing wrong with appealing to self-interest and economic class interest. In the campaign against the Dakota Access Pipeline in Iowa, I was taken aback by how many activists seemed coldly disdainful to the question of how can we find jobs for people employed in the fossil fuels sector after we move to alternative energy. I get it. There's no jobs on a dead planet. But why not tell working people and unions that, as economist Robert Pollan has found, clean energy generates more jobs for a given amount of investment than does maintaining a country's existing fossil fuels infrastructure? Now, I am wrapping up here. The absence of a serious, sustained left is dangerous as hell. I think much more than many people understand. People who are getting shafted and who know it are going to get behind militant politicos seeking to channel their understandable rage. If there's no effective, durable, through thick and thin, organized, intelligent, anti-capitalist left around, the job of working with that popular anger falls by default to xenophobic, white nationalist, neo-fascist, reactionary populists, to the Marine Le Pens, the Geert Wilders, the Matteo Salvinis, Nigel Farages, the Norbert Hofers, the Sebastian Kurzes, the Alexander Garlands, the David Dukes, the Steve Kings, the Jeff Sessions, the Donald Trumps, and the Steve Bannons of the world, because resentment abhors a vacuum. Without a functioning left ready to fight, do real things for everyday people, we will have no way to defend and sustain our households, our families, and communities when the next big capitalist meltdown comes, an event that is overdue and coming in the very near future. Meanwhile, with or without a financial crisis, capitalogenic, I try to get people to move off of anthropogenic and say capitalogenic. Capitalogenic environmental catastrophe looms closer with every passing year as talking heads obsess over this week in Trump and Russia. We are racing to the fatal mark of 500 carbon parts per atmospheric million by 2050, if not sooner. The greenhouse effect is not rocket science. The planless, chaotic, growth-addicted profits system has brought us literally, to quote Chris Hedges, to the cusp of extinction. If we don't get off the march to ecocide, nothing else that we care about on the left is going to matter all that much. We're just going to be arguing about the more equitable sharing out and distribution of the pieces of a poisoned pie. We're going to be turning the world upside down, but unfortunately it's going to be a hopelessly poisoned world. That's historical materialism 101. It's socialism or barbarism if we're lucky. It's eco-socialism or annihilation sooner than many of us dare to acknowledge. If there's no future for a radical mass movement in our time, Istvan Masaros wrote 18 years ago, 16 years ago, there can be no future for humanity ourselves. We have our work cut out for ourselves. Power to the people, power to the workers, power to the commons. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Episode 9 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from journalist, historian, and author Paul Street. Next up is Glenn Ford, Executive Director of Black Agenda Report.
Power to the people. Now, I'm very proud and honored to be among those that Paul Street has allowed to think with him about what an authentic left would look like in the United States. It's something that many of us are thinking about all the time. I think that this authentic left initially would look exactly like it does now, because you have to start from where you are. But it would begin to start talking and behaving quite differently. I think what we are really talking about is, how do we make a movement, a ruling class destroying movement in the United States? Of course, we would be talking about setting in motion several mass-based movements that are linked in their shared enemy, the ruling class, and its organs of coercion and control, the organs that people come up against every time they move, and even if they don't move. And these mechanisms of coercion and control are more than just the police and the mass incarceration gulag. They are more than just those police and jails, plus the vast national security state. It is also the corporate media, which in the last 2 years, certainly, we have witnessed, we have learned how they work hand in glove with the U.S. domestic and international spy agencies. That is obviously what is going down with this Russiagate hysteria. The unity of the oligarchy and the corporate media and the national security state is perfectly personified in the person of Jeff Bezos, the Amazon owner and also owner of the Washington Post, whose company has a $600 million contract with the CIA. Bezos is the richest man in the world. He and two other oligarchs, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, own more wealth than the entire poorest half of the American population. And that is the kind of oligarchic fact that is becoming commonly known out there in this vast 300 million person country. These are monopolists. They are the masters of what they themselves call creative destruction, which is a very grotesque way of them bragging about the huge disruptions that hyperactive capital is causing in U.S. society, and of course, much greater destruction in the global South. The concentration of capital in the U.S. and the global capitalist world has reached such a point that the individuals at the top of the oligarchy, the men and the few white women who are named Walton, can be counted on our fingers. We know most of their names, and much of the public knows most of their names. That is the state of concentration that we have reached. The heads of the big banks that are the queen ants of finance capital, and finance capital is the enemy of all mankind. Those banks can be listed, counted on the fingers of one hand. The crisis of late stage capitalism is all around us, and the people know that the overlapping crises are in motion. They see it all around them. Even those who still have good jobs see the crisis in motion. They talk about it, even if it has not devastated them personally yet. There is fear everywhere in the United States, even among those classes of people who on paper seem to be looking good, especially if they are two good job households. The people also know the names of the oligarchs at the top of the list, many of those names. Most importantly, everybody knows that the banks are criminals, and everybody hates the banks. And that is not a hyperbolic statement. I'll say it again. Everybody, or virtually everybody, hates the banks. The only hatred that rivals in the United States, the only hatred that rivals the hatred of the banks, is the hatred and fear of black people and Muslims and Latino immigrants in U.S. society. But the second biggest hatred is the hatred of the banks, and that's the one we got to work on. A real left wants to overthrow the ruling class, which is centered, of course, in finance capital. Therefore, a real left mass movement for the 21st century must call for nationalization of the banks. That is the logic of history. Now, I said nationalize. That means state takeover. It does not mean a temporary takeover, but a permanent takeover of the banks. We're not talking about just cleaning the crooks out and then giving the banks back to the finance capitalist class, as if there aren't crooks ready to come right back and do the same thing. We're talking about dethroning the bankers. That is, we are making what is, in fact, a revolutionary demand, but one that I am confident is actually a popular demand. In fact, as I said, I think there is no more popular demand than smashing the power of the banks. I think that the genuine left response to this era of crisis is really not so complex. It's not so problematic as some people think that it is. Movements are defined by their demands. If they're not defined by their demands, then we're just talking about some kind of left that of positioning. I'm going to put myself over here next to that group and hope that that will cause these other groups to join me because we're a little better than that other group. That's positioning. It's meaningless, but that's what we do most of the time. No, we must make a demand that goes to the heart of the actual situation, and this happens to be a demand that resonates with the vast majority of people. I didn't say that we should turn Goldman Sachs over to its workers as a cooperative, as I've heard some folks say. I think that is silly. Goldman Sachs and these other monster banks are instruments that have been crafted only for the purpose of the oppression of humankind. That is their one and only purpose. And you might just as well say that you'll solve the race to nuclear annihilation by turning the U.S. strategic triad over to the airmen and sailors and soldiers that man these weapon systems. That is silly and stupid as well. We want to nationalize the banks and put those banks to public purposes. It is a demand that the Occupy movement never made back in 2011. They walked right up to the edge of the pool, but they did not dive in. The core group of Occupy did other silly things. They invited black Obamite preachers into the movement. I know when they did it, one of the central organizers called me up and said he was going to invite Reverend Ben Chavis. to become part of the movement. I told him Reverend Ben Chavis wrote a column every week for a black newspaper, and the column was all about backing Obama, voting for the Democrats, and that's your mission, and that's all. But they went ahead and did it anyway. I have no idea why they did that. But much of the co-optation that occurred with the Occupy movement was self-inflicted. Of course, it was state sponsored as well. Of course, we know that Obama himself directed the ultimate police crackdown. But there were contradictions at the core in the Occupy movement. But the greatest failing was not to jump into the pool. Nevertheless, they left us with a slogan that has popularized the common sentiment, the hatred of the damn banks, that was common in 2011 and came to the fore when the 99% slogan was promulgated. And people should have jumped into the pool, but we've had time to ruminate and refine that 99%. It's had time to percolate among the masses, and I guess that's a good thing. Well, it might as well be a good thing because we can't recoup that 7 years, but we can start right now by diving into the pool. It's not going to be easy to co-opt a demand for the permanent nationalization of the banks. There's not much room for the Democratic Party to come into that and somehow get on the side of that kind of movement that's demanding the nationalization and dethronement of their masters, because the Wall Street bankers are to the Democratic Party what big energy has historically been to the Republican Party. These are the pillars of these corporate parties. We will see what the relationship of forces really looks like. That is, the relationship of forces in society, not the relationship of organizations that call themselves left, but how people move in society when the demand is forcefully and effectively made abroad. We'll see what the relationship of forces really looks like in the United States when the left is pushing a demand that is truly popular on its face and truly transformative as well. The real hard part here is in projecting what takes the place of the private bankers, the so-called Wall Street banks. It is absolutely crucial that the projected new banking configuration, the one that we say will come about in the future as a result of these demands, that that new configuration be seen by the people as providing all of the services that the private bankers currently provide and those services that they used to provide, and many of us remember, but no longer do. Because there will be great anxiety in the land when people think about where are we going to put our money now, the little that we have. And that transformed public banking system will have to be seen as part of the rebuilding of the nation. It is part of the rebuilding project, which is a transformational rebuilding project. And it must be seen that the new regime of development of the nation, that's the rebuilding project, will be a democratic one. And there is room there for all of the debate that we can possibly think we will have. What does a democratic society look like? That is the debate that follows, that flows from, we're going to take over this banking system. And that redevelopment would have to be one that is in service of all the constituencies in the United States. And all of these constituencies, as I said before, hate the banks, and all of them do want transformation there in terms that they can understand. This is especially important to Black Americans, and Black Americans will be the most enthusiastic constituency about smashing the banks. Black Americans are the most left-leaning constituency in the United States. They are most in favor by every measurement of redistribution of income, and they are the most opposed to monopoly in the United States. The bankers and the real estate corporations are the ones who created the ghettos, and everybody knows that. Everybody in the ghetto knows it. And they are also the engines of gentrification, and everybody black understands that as well. There is no need to demonize the bankers in black America. But what you do have to show black America is that this transformed institution is going to be not just of service to them, but that they will have a say in these transformed institutions, in our language, that there will be a self-determinationist aspect to the reorganization of the banks in this country. If we are ever to see a real working unity between blacks and Latinos on the ground, it will be in common opposition to the bankers who are behind gentrification. And gentrification is not just happening in a couple of selected places. Here in New York City, we know where the centers of gentrification are as it moves through the different places in the boroughs and to a lesser extent across the river in New Jersey. But what I've found is that most folks who are under the hammer and threat of gentrification think that it is an isolated situation. They think that this is happening just particularly hard in St. Louis or in Atlanta or in Chicago. But in fact, it's happening everywhere. The banking class, if that's what you want to call them, is on the move with the same plan everywhere in the United States, inflating land assets through gentrification. And the growing Latino populations are moving into or getting moved out of the same neighborhoods as black people. And the commonality there is real. It is day to day. It cries out for collaboration. But I think that can be best achieved in a general movement to smash the banks. And we will see the kind of unity of action among Latinos and blacks that many of us have been wishing for, been frustrated about for a very long time. Several movements would be spawned by this demand for nationalization of the banks. In the last 2 years, it has become absolutely clear to masses of people that the concentrated capital in the Silicon Valley, and we're talking about Google and Facebook and Amazon and other corporations in that industry, is a danger to democracy. It is a danger to the people. It is a growing danger that people are beginning to recognize, and that's not going to go away. And so we need to be talking about what I think organically a demand for intervention in those monopolies who are politically so dangerous, but will also grow out of a demand to nationalize the banks.
You're listening to Episode 9 of Other Voices, Other Choices, with coverage of the 2018 Left Forum. We just heard from Glenn Ford, Executive Director of Black Agenda Report. Next up is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges.
I want to just take about 10 minutes to focus on something that is unfortunately of great concern to all three of us, and that is a very well-orchestrated and potent campaign of censorship against the kind of critique that Bruce and Glenn and Paul and I make. It began with the appearance of a shadowy website called Prop or Not, Propaganda or Not, that, not surprisingly, Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, put on the front page of the Washington Post. It listed left-wing sites, including every site that I write for or that republishes my work, the same with Paul and, of course, Black Agenda Report, as being agents of the Russian government. Truthdig, where I have a weekly column run by the great Bob Scheer out of Los Angeles, got lawyers to contact the Washington Post because these were anonymous. These threats were made anonymously. Nobody ever self-identified who was behind this site. Well, we can all guess. And the Washington Post stonewalled, refused to. Although they said they knew who was behind Proper Not, they refused to identify to us who those people were. They suggested that we contact Proper Not to try and get ourselves off the list. Remember, these are all anonymous accusations, which I should emphasize are completely untrue. And we got nowhere. This was followed by the director of National Intelligence report in January of a year ago, where 7 pages of that report attacked RT America, where I have a show. And it's worth pulling up and reading, because those 7 pages detail exactly why all of us and those of us who take this critique are being targeted. And that has nothing to do with Russia. It has to do, in the language of that report, the fact that on RT America and, of course, on these sites, we are giving voice to anti-fracking activists, Black Lives Matter. I just had John Kiriakou on my show, the security and surveillance state. And when Clapper went before the Congress in his hearing, I got a call from Ralph Nader, and he said, you'll probably read what he said, but don't read it. Pull it up and watch it. Because when they start asking him about RT, it's not just the words that he uses, but the venom, the anger, the rage. And so, built around this idea of fake news, Russian agents, we saw a year ago, April, the imposition of algorithms by Google, Facebook, Twitter that blocked what are called impressions. So, for instance, if you typed in imperialism and Glenn had written an article on imperialism, it might have been before that you would be directed to that article. No more. So, for instance, in the site that I work for, Truthdig, we have a graph of referrals by impressions off of Google, and it has dropped from over 700,000 to below 200,000. As they perfect these algorithms. You've seen the World Socialist website, their traffic has dropped by 80%. Truthdig's traffic has dropped by, I forget, I know Alternet 63%. I don't know, do you have a figure for Black Agenda Report?
We don't have an exact figure, but it's more than half.
More than half. But anyway, all of these sites are being targeted. Now, why? And I think you have to look at what's happening in concert. And as Glenn correctly pointed out, there is a great deal of rage expressed towards a system, what Sheldon Whelan calls inverted totalitarianism, what John Ralston Saul has identified as the corporate coup d'etat, that serves the interests of a tiny cabal, which is now being turbocharged under the Trump administration, you know, with these kind of corporate kleptocrats looting, stealing, pillaging, you know, as fast as they can on the way down. And so suddenly critics such as us, who have already been marginalized, pushed to the fringes of the internet, become dangerous because they really don't, the neoliberal advocates don't have a counter argument. And so the counter argument has to be shut down, which is, of course, what net neutrality, the abolition of net neutrality, is about. It means that, you know, already we're already on the outer reaches of public discourse, but through net neutrality, they can essentially, by tiering the levels, you know, the levels by which you can access sites, they can push us all into a black hole. And that's what's happening as we speak. And it's very frightening and very dangerous. I walk through the halls here and somebody came up and started going after me for being on RT. I didn't go on RT by choice. I went on RT because we don't have a functioning system of public broadcasting. Where people who don't work for a corporation or the defense industry or are a former flack for some president should have a voice. But public broadcasting in this country has completely broken down. PBS is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Koch brothers. The Kochs sit not only do they control PBS and the NewsHour, which is why it's so banal and so boring, but they also sit on the boards of a lot of radio stations, like WGBH in Boston and others. And this has become a war of information. And because these critics essentially have no credibility left, their only response is silencing anti-imperialist and anti-capitalist critics, which is what all of us are enduring. As Paul correctly pointed out, the system, the financial system of global speculation is completely unsustainable. I'm not an economist. I don't know when it's coming. But at a certain point, it's going to implode. And as Nomi Prins points out, the difference between the next meltdown and the 2008 meltdown is that they have no plan B. They can't reduce interest rates to virtually zero because they've already introduced rates to virtually zero. They have built an entire economic system on what Marx called fictitious capital, i.e. the fiction that money makes money, that you don't have to manufacture or produce anything. So the kleptocrats get their tax cut, and what do they do with the money? They buy back their stock because it inflates the stock value to which their compensation packages are tied. They borrow tremendous amounts of money, and they don't actually invest it into the economy in a traditional way. They hoard it, or they use it to carry out punishing debt peonage on the rest of the population, because even though they borrowed it at 0% interest, it does have to be paid back. And so that is why if you are late on your credit card bill, it jumps to 28%. That is why even if you are fortunate enough to have health insurance, you are hit with this fee, that fee. That is why utility prices are through the roof, including the monopolies that we have, like Comcast. That is why students are being burdened with student loans, the largest personal debt in the country. But ultimately, it's not a sustainable system. And the danger, as many economists have pointed out, is that this time around, you are going to watch an attack or an assault by, in a multipolar world, China, Russia, the Middle East. We already saw, you know, one of the reasons they're going after Iran is they no longer use the dollar as the reserve currency, by the way. And at a certain point, the propping up of the dollar by making it the reserve currency will collapse, and the economy in the United States will go into freefall. And if you want to know what happens economically when your currency is no longer the reserve currency, look at what happened in Britain in the 1950s when the pound sterling was removed as the reserve currency. Suddenly, imports become extremely expensive. Nobody wants to buy treasury bonds. The borrowing that we carry out to maintain empire, we have expanded beyond our capacity to sustain empire. It falls in on itself with tremendous internal unrest, especially by a population that doesn't have access to information that is able to explain to it what's happened. And that gives, of course, potency to demagogues. I think as Noam Chomsky correctly points out, don't be too excited about impeaching Trump because you're going to get Pence. And as Noam says, Pence is worse. And I spent 2 years, first of all, I'm a seminary graduate, although I went to Harvard Divinity School, which has probably produced more atheists than any other seminary in America. But I wrote a book on the Christian right. I spent 2 years with them. And when I say 2 years with them, I did it the way W.B. Du Bois did the Philadelphia Negro or Souls of Black Votes. I went and sat through entire weekend, pro-life weekends and creationist seminars. I took a seminar on evangelism explosion with D. James Kennedy. So I was in these mega churches all over the country. And the title of the book is called American Fascists: The Christian Right and the War on America. I was trying to reach out to them. And I didn't use the word fascist lightly. In fact, I went to Fritz Stern, who wrote The Politics of Cultural Despair, grew up in Nazi Germany, to allow him over several hours to argue me out of the word. And then I went up to Paxton in Columbia, who wrote The Anatomy of Fascism, the scholar on Vichy, and did the same thing. And it's you can buy the book, so I won't go into a long discussion of it, but it functions as a fascist entity with the fusion of religious symbols with the iconography and language of nationalism, which is precisely what the German Christian Church did under the Nazis. And you have a white male megachurch, usually a millionaire, who is in direct touch with God. It replicates cults in that you have the feel-good service where you're all drawn in and everybody sings and loves you and you have disciples. And that's the public kind of Venus flytrap. And then you are sucked into the systems of indoctrination where you're severed from your family, all your recreation time, all your educational time, and Hannah Arendt writes exactly about this as an element. But the most important commonality with totalitarian system is the magical thinking. All totalitarian systems have magical thinking. And Trump has no ideology. He doesn't have enough of a brain to have an ideology. But into that vacuum, that ideological vacuum, we're already watching the Christian right. And should we get collapse without a rational, open debate, an open society, critics of the system are not going to have a voice. The only voice that's going to be amplified are the amplification of demagogues, racists, nativists, and Christian fascists. And what we must not forget about Christian fascism in this country is that it has an ideology, it has an educational infrastructure, it has a media infrastructure, it has an infrastructure in terms of building cadre. That's what Liberty University and the Oral Roberts University, where I'm happy to say my book on the Christian right is banned, and actually has underground copies. And so I warn you that what we're facing in the months, I don't know, nobody knows when this will happen. The bankers don't know, of course, is extremely dangerous, especially given the propensity for violence that runs as a dark undercurrent through American society. The, you know, all of the forms of social control that have been visited on poor people of color, mass incarceration, militarized police that use indiscriminate lethal force and terror, collapse of a court system. Nobody in the inner city gets a trial. I teach in a prison. They all have to plea out. And actually, the students I teach with the longest sentences are the ones who were fool enough to go to trial, usually the ones who did not commit what they were charged with. And they're given everything on their sheet. I mean, I taught a guy at Trenton. He had life plus 154 years, and he'd never committed a violent crime. So as Hannah Arendt writes in The Origins of Totalitarianism, the danger of a society that makes rights privileges, which is essentially what rights have become, means that in a moment of widespread social unrest, you have both the legal and the physical mechanism to impose that kind of tyranny, and tyranny is the right word for what poor people of color live under, on the rest of society. So I will close only by saying, and I can't reiterate it enough, that we have to be very conscious of the political system we live in. It is not a democracy. It is a failed democracy. Trump is not the disease. He is the symptom of the disease. Our institutions, our so-called democratic institutions, including, of course, the Democratic Party, which doesn't even really function as a political party in the traditional sense of a political party, have seized up and are utterly ineffectual. Every effort that we make to reform or attempt to work with these institutions is an utter and complete waste of energy and time. We have to look to South Africa as our model, and that means non-cooperation. We have to blow the entire system up. Otherwise, we are facing a species of very frightening corporate tyranny and ecocide. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 9 of Other Voices, Other Choices. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of the series. This episode features a panel from the 2018 Left Forum, held June 1st through 3rd in New York City, entitled Imagining an Authentic 21st Century U.S. Left, and includes talks by Paul Street, Glenn Ford, and Chris Hedges. You can find Other Voices, Other Choices on iTunes and YouTube. Thanks for listening.